Good afternoon. We're going to get started. My name is Paul Anderson. I'm one of the board of directors for the Fishermen's Forum, and so on behalf of the board, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon. This is kind of a continuing conversation on something that started this morning. There was a very popular session down the hall, probably a lot of you were there, on the National Ocean Policy and more in particular coastal marine spatial planning and how that looks and feels from the federal perspective. And we heard a really good panel kind of putting some definition to the words that we're all hearing in this National Ocean Policy discussion. This afternoon, we're taking that a little bit deeper and talking a little bit more about how it's probably being applied here in Maine, more specifically to offshore wind. And so the title of the session indeed is about giving you an update on what's happening with offshore renewable energy, in particular offshore wind energy development. As most of you know, the University of Maine has a lot of effort going on right now with some pilot testing and some research and development, both on campus and eventually out on the water. And then recently there was an assessment report released about some of the issues and the potential opportunities and challenges of commercializing larger scale offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine. And then, you know, who knows where that's all going to go, and the context of coastal marine spatial planning as a tool for helping decision makers make the right decision is kind of woven into this conversation. So we have a good panel here today. I want to thank Heather Dees from the Island Institute for taking leadership and organizing it, and I'll let her introduce the panel and she'll moderate the session, and I'll push the slide button.
Thank you everybody for coming this afternoon, and also in addition to Paul, Mary Beth Tooley, who organized the panel this morning on the National Oceans Policy, was really helpful in coordinating the two discussions back and forth, and a number of other people from around the state helped to sort of determine some of the ideas and topics that we wanted to focus on today. And I particularly wanted to recognize Richard Nelson from Friendship, who helped to identify some questions that he thought might be particularly interesting to fishermen. So we do have a great panel here, and what we'd like to do for the session is run through four presentations from our panelists, and unless anybody has an immediate burning question after the talks, we're going to try to hold questions so that we can have a substantial half an hour question and answer period for the second part of the session to have it really be a discussion back and forth. So I just wanted to mention that there are a number of topics that we unfortunately couldn't fit into the panelists today. We have some topics that I know are probably of interest to people around the economics of offshore wind energy, environmental impacts, and other details about potentially some of the projects happening off the coast here in Maine. And we just didn't have time to cover everything, so I just wanted to acknowledge that and also point out that we do have some more resources. There are a couple of fact sheets on the back table, and there are also a number of online websites that some of the speakers will refer you to for more information. So the focus is basically trying to understand what's the relationship between marine spatial planning and offshore wind energy, particularly off the coast of Maine, likely to look like, or what do we want it to look like, and who is going to make those decisions, and how can fishermen in particular be involved in that process. So in order to approach that, we have speakers from the Maine State Planning Office. Matt Nixon is going to start us off, and then we'll have some other perspectives from Rhode Island, DC, the New England Fishery Management Council to kind of give a little bit of a stepping away and coming back to the region perspective on this question. So Matt Nixon is the senior planner at the Maine Coastal Program, a senior planner at the, apparently they have multiple senior planners, at the Maine Coastal Program, which is currently housed at the State Planning Office. He was provided staff support for the Ocean Energy Task Force that met over 2008-2009, and he also provides staff support for the Working Waterfront efforts from the State Planning Office. He is a GIS whiz and handles a lot of data related to questions for offshore discussions. So I'll turn it over to Matt.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for the introduction, Heather. Happy to be here. There is a something I should let you folks know, we are going to be, Heather and I will be tag teaming on a certain portion here. I'm going to be covering past initiatives in the state of Maine related to ocean energy. Heather will be covering a few more specifics related to the Monhegan test site that I'll be covering briefly here. So I guess, to begin, as Heather had said, there has been a lot of ocean energy work done in the state over the past couple of years. Back up one. All right. This is what we're going to be covering today related to those efforts. I guess the first one would be an active facilitation testing of ocean energy and demonstration of ocean energy facilities in the state. It's basically LD 1465. I'll get to that in a little bit. The Maine Public Utilities Commission RFP and the Monhegan test site update that I just mentioned that Heather will be covering. Continuing on. So, just to cover the demonstration siting process, the act I mentioned earlier. In 2008, Governor Baldacci signed an executive order basically commissioning the Ocean Energy Task Force, which was a group of experts, state officials, industry experts as well, university officials, to try and figure out how to jumpstart the ocean energy industry in the state of Maine. And they came out with two pieces of legislation. The first one was an interim task force report, LD 1465, the interim report. And basically what that did was charge the Department of Conservation and the State Planning Office, with consultation from the State Planning Office, to site up to 5 ocean energy demonstration sites in the coast of Maine. And by coast of Maine, I mean out to the 3 nautical mile limit, as that is what the legislature and the state has jurisdiction over. The second piece of legislation, which I'll be covering a little bit later, but just to give a brief summary of it now, was basically initiating some of the final recommendations. So first up, we have LD 1465. Like I said, I just sort of explained some of that. One of the primary focuses here was looking at deeper water. Maine has a very sharp drop-off off the OCS. It gets pretty deep really quick. And one of the positives about that is we can test new technology that doesn't exist anywhere else. You'll find conventional monopole technology is what's being proposed on a Cape Wind. The jacketed technology for wind power is what's being proposed in Rhode Island. What we're looking at in Maine is really the opportunity for deep water floating platforms that aren't standing on poles or cemented in the mud in one fixed position. So, we initially started off with 7 large planning areas. It looks like 8, there are really 7. The Matinicus area, I wish I could leave the microphone here. Can you guys all hear me like this? Is that?
Yeah.
All right.
So good.
Very good. So this area right here was originally one large area. It was broken up due to some recommendations by federal agencies and some other stakeholder input. To find these areas, we basically used several criteria, very basic criteria. We were looking for depth, we were looking for wind speed, and we were looking for the absence of unexploded ordinances, dredge spoil dump sites, that sort of thing, absence of Coast Guard recognized shipping lanes. Shoot, Rod, I forgot. We're recording. Hope I'm still getting on.
Take the mic out, bro.
All right. There we go. Okay. So, after we established these initial planning areas, this is what we came up with for planning areas, based on that very preliminary analysis of spatial data. So after we came up with those planning areas, we went out, we had approximately 40 meetings up and down the coast of Maine, talking with primarily fishermen and other stakeholder groups. Friends of Acadia, for instance, one of the areas is located off Isle of Ho, which is part of Acadia National Park. We wanted to have some input from them. And these were small meetings, consisting of lobstermen. We had some draggers present as well. And the idea was to get some feedback on what they thought about these areas first, because the initial analysis hadn't used any stakeholder input. That had just been to find out where can we do this in the state. Cue it up here. So this is an animation. There we go. So we initially started off with a map like this. This is the Cutler planning area. We had grid cells with 1 through 5, you know, letters on the bottom. Basically, we asked stakeholders to take a look at this and use this comment sheet to look. No problem, Paul. To take a look at this, the map, and use the comment sheet to put in the designation on the left-hand side, and then a comment, and basically tell us what part of this is good for an ocean energy demonstration project and what part is not. And we got some really good responses back. It was actually in one of my first slides. There was a picture of the Monhegan response, which we can go back to later if you folks want to see what some of that looks like. Continuing on, after that initial stakeholder outreach, we took that information, we digitized it, we overlaid it with the planning areas. Then we began another review, additional spatial data collection, biological habitat information, geophysical, additional human use activities like vessel traffic, scenic areas, National Historic Registry sites. There are a number of different criteria listed in the Maine Wind Power Act that you can take a look at that LD 1465 told us to follow as well. Continue. So basically, we had four draft areas. We had one near Boone Island. That big red dot in the middle is actually the Empire Knight. It's a shipwreck full of mercury, and we wanted to make sure we avoided that. The one to the upper right-hand corner is Damaris Cove. Obviously, these areas right here, these are the test sites, the draft sites. These larger areas are the planning areas. We had one near Monhegan and also one off Cutler. So we initially dropped Cutler due to concerns from a number of stakeholders and federal agencies as well, including the Navy. There's a large listening station up there that the Navy still uses. Press it one more time, I think. There we go. So these are our final three sites. We were initially charged with siting up to five. We chose three. One of those sites, per legislation, was to be the university's test site. And what I mean by test site is basically testing ocean energy devices that are not in use anywhere else in the Gulf of Maine. And it's up for a time delineated period. It can only be out there for a certain amount of time, and it's limited by the number of pieces of equipment that can be in the water. In most cases, I know the university is proposing one turbine just to test the actual, Heather can get the specifics for that. So here are some of the activities that can happen within the site in addition. You can have up to three met towers, one submerged utility line, either up to the 25 megawatts or the amount of electricity that could be produced by that one turbine. You don't want to put a 50 gigawatt cable going out to a test site. It doesn't really bode very well. Or wave energy test project is a source. You guys can check out the law for yourself if you'd like. And I think we're on to Heather's portion.
I'm going to do this quickly in the interest of moving along. There's a lot of information about the test site projects available on the websites of some conferences that have happened recently in the state. So if you Google University of Maine, Monhegan Offshore Wind Test Site, there are lots of PowerPoints from some conferences in November, December, and January this year. So quickly, I'm working at the Island Institute to help co-manage the environmental impacts research associated with this project. And the proposal that's currently being put together for permit applications to state and federal agencies, as Matt mentioned, is for a deployment of one or two turbines on floating platforms, with the floating platforms of different designs being the purpose of the research test to identify how those different platform types actually perform in real wind wave conditions at sea. And that's prefaced by tank testing in a tank overseas with a wave and combined wind tank testing, as well as environmental monitoring. Down the bottom, these are the three types of platforms generically that are under consideration for testing. So through the university, which receives Department of Energy funding, there are a number of different organizations working on the entire project. This list just gives you an idea of the scope of the work, from geophysical work to environmental monitoring for marine species, through the actual permitting and design and engineering and construction, fabrication and deployment. Next slide. Because the environmental impacts is the piece I'm particularly involved with, which I'm co-managing with Dr. Pete Umars, who's the director of the School of Marine Sciences and is in the audience here. So either here, I could answer more questions about this later. The pictures sort of give you an idea of the scope of studies. We have nine principal investigators working on a total of seven different projects from many different organizations, research organizations, to basically try to do a really comprehensive look pre and during post-deployment of what the actual change is as a result of the deployment of these test turbines. So that's it. Okay, so this is jumping to another topic, which Matt, I think, is going to cover in a minute, and Paul Anderson mentioned, which is that the University of Maine just recently, I think last week or the week before, released a major report, which is hundreds and hundreds of pages, is available online. Again, Google University of Maine Offshore Wind Energy. And it's a feasibility study, sort of an attempt to gather all of the relevant information that might be important for stakeholders or developers or managers in trying to take at least a first look at the potential for offshore wind development at least 10 miles from shore, because that's the criteria for a particular RFP that Matt will mention. And the idea is to contribute to that report by documenting what we could of the concerns and questions and priorities of marine stakeholders along the coast of Maine. And this is a summary, just a few points that we heard from people about their particular concerns related to siting and some preferences from the fishing community. I'm not sure, is there another? This is another piece of that report, which is some mapping work that we're doing at the Institute with many partners around the region trying to identify fishing areas offshore that might be relevant to the discussions around offshore wind siting. And these maps are included in that draft report.
Okay, I had mentioned that there were two pieces of legislation and basically two reports that came out of the Ocean Energy Task Force. These are the final recommendations, or some of the final recommendations, of the task force. It basically tweaked some of the renewable energy goals for the state, and by goals I mean they're just goals. It's not a statute or anything like that. And the idea is to increase the use of offshore renewable energy in the event that home heating and transportation fuel goes up. I'm not sure if you folks have noticed, but it cost me $30 to fill up my 10-gallon tank this morning. So it is going up. Thanks, sir. So to accomplish some of these changes, one of the recommendations that the task force put forth was to issue some sort of RFP. This was written into legislation, LD 1810, passed nearly unanimously in the legislature. Basically provides for a request for proposals for up to a 30 megawatt project. 25 megawatts of that can come from wind. And the stipulations of the RFP are that it has to be at least 10 nautical miles from the mainland coast or any inhabited island and in 300 feet of water or deeper. So there are some geographic restrictions. The due date for response to this RFP is May 1st. So that's coming right up around the corner. There may be responses, there may not be. Not really sure about that. Here are some sources that Heather had mentioned. If you folks are interested in looking up any of this information, this has been a really cursory presentation. I have to apologize for that. There was a lot more that went into this siting initiative. And if you folks have any interest in that, additional questions, please do not hesitate to contact myself, my boss, Kathleen Layden, and the crowd. The Department of Conservation has a great website, which is up here, which sort of details the process step by step. I think that's about it, actually. Continue on, yeah. That's it. And I guess we can have questions after everyone present.
We can also leave that one up at the end during the question and answer, if that's helpful.
Get that.
Okay, so our next speaker is going to be Dave Butel, who was kind enough to travel up here from Rhode Island to talk with us today, and we're really grateful for that. He has over 35 years of experience working in fisheries, both as a commercial fisherman, as a gear manufacturer, and running a small fishery support business, and then working in fisheries extension and research associated with Rhode Island Sea Grant, and most recently with the Rhode Island Coastal Resources Management Council, where he serves as the coordinator for fisheries and aquaculture. He was heavily involved with the Rhode Island SAMP process and involving fisheries individuals, organizations, and interests in that process, so he's going to talk with us about that and how it relates to offshore wind energy siting. Please, down in there and after the woods.
Thank you, Heather. hope everybody can hear me because I'd like to walk around while I speak. But if you can't, let me know and I'll come back and use the microphone. So in Rhode Island, we have completed the first round of our marine spatial plan, and it's called the Rhode Island Ocean SAM. SAM means Special Area Management Plan. In fact, we've completed it. It's gone through our legislature. It was approved, and now we're already on our First Amendment. So it was completed back in October, but we continue to work to refine this, as will happen with any marine spatial plan. Any planning exercise never ends. So, but there are certainly some reference points. And what I'm going to do today is go through quickly what we did in Rhode Island, look at some of the mapping efforts that we did with the fishing industry, and end with a piece on what were the concerns about wind power in particular for the Rhode Island SAMP that came from the fishing industry. So in the development of this plan, we used a major stakeholder process. We have three slides here of stakeholders. And I know we're going through these quickly, so you can't really read it all. But the fourth slide here has what I think are the important ones for this group. And that is, these are our fishery stakeholders. And it is virtually every fishing association in Rhode Island. All of the commercial ones, and one of the major recreational association, and the Charter and Party Boat Association, which kind of blends both worlds. We had numerous meetings to work with just this group, as well as with the larger stakeholder group from the first three slides. What we did was meet monthly, go over the issues with the larger group. All of the fishing industry stakeholders were involved in the larger group. Plus, we met about twice a month with this group, in addition to the stakeholders meeting. This went on for 2 years. So, a lot of meetings. We also, in developing this plan, had a technical advisory committee. There was all of the fishing associations, plus a lot of other experts in related fields. People who understand fisheries and what is important in any marine spatial plan. Now, part of all of this is we did a series of maps, and we did two levels of maps. One was qualitative maps, working directly with the industry, with the fishing industry. The second was to develop maps based on vessel trip reports over a 10-year span. Use the 10-year span for that so that we would smooth over some of the differences that occurred because of management. And now we did this knowing full well that VTRs have their own whole set of problems. But it was an interesting piece. Anyway. So this is the recreational and charter boat areas. And one of the things the fishing industry told us from the start was the entire area is used. And now for our entire area, in Rhode Island, while we were developing a plan for state waters, because this is how this has to go, the dashed line goes about 30 miles offshore. So we were developing the plan for state waters, getting that approved at the state level, and then applying for federal consistency with the federal agencies. Once federal consistency is obtained, if it's obtained, we can exercise some fairly significant level of influence over what goes on in the offshore waters beyond 3 miles. And our research really included all of that area that's in the dashed line go offshore.
Next slide.
This is the area that's used by our fixed gear fishing. So we're dividing it out into three categories: recreational, fixed gear, and mobile gear. Fixed gear for us is our lobster pots and gill nets, and a few floating fish traps, which are weirs.
Next one, please, Paul.
This is an example of one of the VTR reports. So it's over a 10-year span. It's only for gill net. One of the reasons that we use this for the fixed gear one, the resolution that any reporting is done in our lobster gear, you could not come up with any small locations. And these blocks here are 1 minute squares. Here's our mobile gear. Fishing map, and for us that bottom trawling, which is that is the predominant industry in Rhode Island. Bottom trawling, scalloping, midwater trawling, the little purse seining. Those were the inputs for this one. Next. This one is just the bottom trawling VTR report. The darker the color, the more activity there is in any 1 minute square. And the really dark ones are over 300 reported trips for that area.
Next one, Paul.
So in the qualitative side, we're jumping back here, this is the combined map from recreational, fixed, and mobile gear. And just like the fisherman had told us from the start, the whole area is used. You might see a little spot here, and here that nobody claimed, but in my mind, we didn't look hard enough to find the right people, because I'm sure those areas are used. And when I say we didn't look hard enough to find the right people, we have a lot of meetings, but I'm sure that they're out there.
Thank you, Paul.
Here's the same area with the combined VTR report. So what the darker colors show is a level of intensity for certain areas. But the whole map shows that the whole area is used. Now, when you look at this, there's a big white spot in the middle, right? You have to remember there is no lobster data on here. That is the prime lobster interest. So in essence, in reality, this is all used.
Next
one. So in doing this, in working with our fishermen, he established a level of trust. And the fishing industry wanted us to at least mention, if not address, what their greatest concerns were in our ocean sand. And easily the number one, and these aren't really ranked, but I did put the first one, access was their biggest concern. Are we going to have access? If there's a wind farm, can we get in there? Will we be able to fish? Number one concern. What is the answer? It's not up to us. It's not up to our agency. This was an answer that will come from the Coast Guard, or it may come from Homeland Security. The answer that we obtained from working with our local Coast Guard folks was, as of now, we require no exclusions. That sounds good. That didn't make the industry real happy, because that's only as of now. What about 6 months from now? So we couldn't address that, but we put the question in the plan. Other pieces. How will this affect our transit routes? How would a wind farm affect our radar? Will there be travel lanes through? How will weather impacts be dealt with for us traveling in, around, through? And really, What are all the safety issues? The economics piece, I only gave it one bullet, but this could fill up the whole 15-minute presentation. You know, and it's the economics from the fishing industry end. How much money are we going to lose if we can't fish in this area? How much money are we going to lose if spawning areas or juvenile habitat or fishing areas are lost or migration patterns are changed? So there's that end, but are the wind turbines worth it? Is the energy that's going to come from it cost effective? So all of those questions as well. One of the other big questions with them was liability. Who's going to be liable? Who's going to be liable if you hit a turbine? Those sorts of things. There's no clear answer to all of this. We found some answers. But these are questions that in any plan and in any development really need to be addressed. A couple other things that, you know, I'm sure you all can read, the habitat impacts. Just mention this a little bit, but you know, what's going to cause these? So the farm itself, yes. Scouring areas around the farm, around each individual turbine, yes. The cable route, yes. What else about the cable route? The electromagnetic field that will be around any cable transmitting electricity. These are, once again, things that need to be addressed. They are opportunities for the research industry. Because these things need to be explored to determine what the effects are. A couple more things. The last one up there, noise. So the noise of operation, the noise of construction. What will that do to the fish? That's what the fishing industry cares about. There are lots of other groups on the stakeholders. So certainly the noise with environmental groups, we're very concerned about that. The bird groups were concerned about, you know, bird migration, but I don't really want to address that today. I want to just stick to the fishing side. And one of the biggest challenges in all of this was that the fishing industry does not understand the process. And that's the fault of the people conducting the process. To me, it means our outreach has not been sufficient. Because the people that are involved, and the fishing industry is easily the biggest stakeholder in this, they need to understand what's going on and how it's going on. A real example of the lack of understanding right now is the whole thing going on in Massachusetts. I'm sure you've all heard about the RFI process, Request for Interest. People are all upset about this because they think all of these blocks are going to be leased, and that's not what's going on. I'm sure Wright will address this a little bit, but you know, a request for interest is not a lease. It's just a request for interest. But if people don't understand that, they lead to all kinds of conclusions. So this is my final slide. I'm going to be here both today and tomorrow, and Sarah Smith, thank you, Sarah. Sarah was on the Ocean Sam Fisheries team. Really, she was the primary writer of the chapter. And we're going to be here. We would like to interact with anyone that wants to discuss what the issues are, what they view as the issues are in wind farms in particular. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. I think it's really helpful for all of us to hear the stories from your area, and I think it gives us a lot of good food for thought for discussions along the coast of Maine. So next up is Wright Frank, who I think will definitely be addressing a little bit about that 3,000 square mile area south of Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Wright Frank is in the policy group of the Offshore Alternative Energy Program at the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which I'm going to pronounce BOEM. And he works with companies, developers, other government agencies, and all kinds of stakeholders around trying to develop what is a currently developing and changing process for leasing submerged lands, leasing for offshore alternative energy projects. So he deals with fee structures, transmission lines, auctions, financial assurance. He's the project coordinator from the BOEM side for the Cape Wind Energy Project. And he also has worked actively with the groups in the Mid-Atlantic on the state and regional level working on offshore renewables.
Great, thank you.
Presentation. Go ahead and next slide. Okay, this is just a kind of the overview of what I'll be addressing today. Who we are. I know that fishermen have really have a long history of dealing with certain federal government agencies, and we're not one of them in this part of the world. So we'll kind of I'll give you an introduction to who we are. The roles of other offshore other federal agencies in the offshore renewable energy arena, what our statutory responsibilities are, just a very quick overview of what our leasing process is, opportunities for participation for people who want to give comments or some other way to drive the process and have an effect on what we're doing, and at the very end, just a brief introduction to task forces and wind energy areas. So we're in the Department of the Interior. We are not really related to NOAA at all, which I know is a federal agency that, Commerce is a federal agency that you guys have a lot of experience with. We're the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement. We used to be known as the Minerals Management Service until somewhat recently. And I am in the Alternative Energy Programs side of the house. So I guess our last bullet here says that we also do oil and gas drilling, and that was our nexus to offshore structures. We got our mandate authority in the Energy Policy Act of 2005 to produce or support production, transportation, or transmission of energy from sources other than oil and gas in the Outer Continental Shelf. So basically, it's not just wind or hydrokinetics. If you wanted to put a coal plant on the Outer Continental Shelf, that would also be us under this. The Outer Continental Shelf is 3 miles to the edge of the Continental Shelf, up to 200 miles, and we have nothing to do with the Great Lakes. Back to one thing. One thing that can be a little confusing, a lot of states are introducing incentives to development of offshore wind power, and so a lot of times you'll see states getting involved in federal waters outside the 3 mile boundary. We would do the leasing. Any of these incentives would be handled by the state. So it's going to be some sort of a complicated matching up of the state RFP processes and our selection procedures. These are the other agencies that I can come up with a small amount of effort who have jurisdiction over the OCS. From Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, EPA, Coast Guard, Army Corps of Engineers, National Park Service, Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, tribes, the FAA, and states are just a few, and you have some of their authorities up there as well. Really, this all comes together in the NEPA process where we involve each equity holder in their review. These are our statutory responsibilities. It says specifically that we should look after these things. A little closer? Okay. So we have safety, protection of the environment, prevention of waste. I guess I'm not going to read all of them. You can see them. But some of them that I put in red, fisheries are in there. Ensuring an opportunity for public comment on proposals, prevention of interference with regional uses, and protecting the environment. So. We've implemented these in various ways. For example, I've heard concern that if some developer is not doing their job right and the storm comes through and knocks things down and washes a lot of garbage up. We hold financial assurance. We hold bonding in the amount that the government would need to go and clean all that up if that happens. So, you know, that's one way in which we're implementing these things in our process. And this is the process, just in a very simplified way. We get a proposal that could be sent to us or solicited by us. We're really trying to encourage our process where we solicit proposals, because that gives us an opportunity to avoid conflicts up front rather than just proceeding reactively. We're really not moving reactively, you know, in direct response to a proposal we've received, with very few exceptions, because we want to have an opportunity to talk to all the stakeholders and all, you know, identify all the uses that are out there and make sure we're going out in an area that makes sense. We do a qualification process to make sure that this isn't you know, some fly-by-night operation. We initiate discussions with state, federal agencies, tribes. This is our these are our state task forces. I've heard some people complain that they're not as inclusive as they could be. These are intergovernmental task forces because of the Federal Advisory Committee Act. So we're a little constrained by that, but we really look for as much input as we can. And then part of our mandate is that we have to do things competitively unless there's a determination that there's no competitive interest. So everything goes out with an RFI or a call or some other kind of public notice to say, who else is interested in this area? Publicly, do we need to hold an auction? Do we not need to hold an auction? And that is always an opportunity for the public and other stakeholders to submit comments. And then we issue the lease. We either auction it if there's competitive interest, or we issue the lease non-competitively if there's not. The lessee submits its plans for a site assessment plan to conduct research on the area and pull together the data and other information it needs to do a construction operation plan, and then it submits a construction operation plan. And this is a new decision point for us. It's not a foregone conclusion that because we have a construction operations plan, it's going to go through. We can deny these as well. So if the plans are approved, the lessee may build. In time frames, I get a lot of comments on how long is the time frame that we're looking at here. This depends on so many things, from the preparedness of developers to lawsuits to everything. The how well established the technology is in Maine. They're talking floating technology, which is I think there's only one floating turbine in the world right now in the North Sea. So it's really hard to predict, but I would, you know, if I had to guess, I'd say between 5 and 15 years for a time range. Okay, I put up, I assume the slide presentation will be available at some point, but these are some of the opportunities there are for public input, and a lot of this, these are notice and comment periods. We read them all, we get thousands, we take them seriously, and especially in a new field where we're more than willing to admit our ignorance on certain aspects of the OCS and what's out there, we really take the comments of those with that knowledge very seriously. These are just the major elements of the framework: coordination, leasing, payments. And then the bonding that I mentioned earlier is up there. Plans and requirements for plans, conduct of approved activities, and decommissioning. So it goes right through, 35 years from now or whenever it would be when someone would have to pay to take all these things down. Our rule is on our website. Download there. Our activities right now in Maine, Boulder Maine Renewable Energy Task Force. It convened initially last fall. We take our coordination with the state and other agencies very seriously. We're currently, I think, we're awaiting a direction from the new administration here in Maine. But and then it is intergovernmental. So although We open the meetings to the public and have a question and answer period afterwards. For legal reasons, we can't take them on as members. Wind energy areas are areas where it's a new initiative that the secretary has put forward, where instead of instead of going reactively, we'll do environmental assessments proactively, find some areas on the Outer Continental Shelf, do a NEPA analysis on the effects of surveying and leasing. And these, again, I think this touches on what was said earlier, that these areas are far larger than anyone could reasonably expect to be developed. There's just the economics wouldn't be there if the interest was there. This is really, you can imagine from our perspective, there's two ways to find the area you want. You can either put a small circle out there and see how that goes, or you can put a large circle out there and learn as much as you can over a broad area and try to direct the development where you think it makes more sense. And we're really going from wide to narrow. You've seen that throughout our regions. But that does lead to a little shock sometimes, I think, when someone sees the map for the first time. Oh my God, that area is huge. Well, yeah, it's huge, but that's what we're looking at right now. So, all right, thank you. If you have any questions, I think we'll be taking questions after.
And we can definitely, for the panelists who would like to, we can make the presentations available either through the Island Institute website, or we can check the FinOne Forum website as well. Thank you, Wright, for that. Last up, we have Paul Howard, who most of you probably know. He's the Executive Director of the New England Fishery Management Council. He's also a captain in the Coast Guard, and beyond that, I don't think Paul needs very much introduction, and I just wanted to say thank you for coming up and sharing some insights into how the Council is engaging in these processes for the Gulf of Maine.
Thank you, Heather. Good afternoon, everyone. I'll speak from here, if you don't mind, and keep it very informal. Last July, when the President signed the executive order for coastal marine spatial planning, and it created the National Ocean Council and the Governance Coordinating Committee and regional planning bodies. At that time that the executive order was signed, we decided to take marine spatial planning seriously. And so we were Johnny Come Latelys in the fish business on the regional level. And at that point, I reached out to NROC, the heir apparent for the regional planning bodies, to have fisheries at the table and become a member of the regional planning bodies. We have limited resources at the council and all the federal governments, state governments, and I thought our attention to address fishing would be best at that regional planning level. Because at that regional planning level, they were to develop and are to develop comprehensive plans on a regional level and have all the stakeholders at the table. So that's where all my initial efforts were. And then I found out, Johnny Come Lately, that Bomer had task forces that were going on that were not focused regionally, as intended in the national policy, but we're focused on a state-by-state level. We're not comprehensive in nature, looking at all energy needs, but just looking at wind, and did not have all the stakeholders at the table. And it seemed to me that the regional planning bodies were on like a 2 to 5 year planning schedule to get a comprehensive plan done. And I felt that these task forces throughout the region were on a much accelerated time frame to get wind energy sited. So I quickly changed focus, and now the participation on the regional planning bodies will be secondary with our limited resources, and we're going to pay an awful lot of attention to the task forces. First slide, please. So from a regional level now, instead of going from one regional planning body The council is now going to address task forces in Maine, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island that currently exist. There's no interest to date with a task force from New Hampshire or Connecticut. Massachusetts does have an RFI, and I'll discuss some of our comments that we're preparing on the RFI. Maine does not have an RFI, request for information, request for interest. I understand from talking to Dave that Rhode Island has what's called a area of mutual interest, an AMI. So we'll be requesting that we become members of those task forces from Bomer, and if there are some concerns about FACA, as Wright had mentioned, then we'll at least ask to have some type of consultative role. And in addition to the regional, or not regional, to the federal state task forces, I understand Maine has a state task force alone, and that Massachusetts has state initiatives that are within 3 miles. Next slide, please. We have, I recently called Bomer in Washington, I think it's Wright's supervisors, and Ted Bowling from Bomer will be coming to the council at our April meeting, April 26th and 27th. So if you're interested in hearing about from Wright's supervisors about the task forces and fisheries involvement, they'll be at the April council meeting. And I'm hoping that these task forces will recognize that the regional fisheries councils can bring regional experience, experience based on science, experience dealing with stakeholders from commercial land fishing interests, and also management responsibilities across a regional level to the task forces and to the regional planning bodies. So in preparation of the council getting into marine spatial planning and having our fishing interests at the table wherever fish is on the menu, as I like to say. I went down to the Northeast Fishery Science Center and asked them if they could provide me with a bunch of data on, you know, fishing effort, fishing grounds, what is caught, bottom type, all this information. And they were more than willing to do that. And from the Science Center ecosystem branch, I got a lot of great data that is going to serve us well, the fishing community and fishery managers, in dealing with both the task forces and with NROC. And I'll quickly go through these. This data was based on logbook entries, which again have their problems, some 40 plus years of survey data, and also observer coverage, which is more accurate than, say, logbooks. Next slide, please. So this is a slide of the Gulf of Maine. And I have this information from what I call three ecosystem production units, the Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank, and Southern New England. So this shows Georges Bank, and it shows the bottom sediment types. Next slide. This is Science Center benthic survey bottom species, and it shows the total species within 10-minute squares. Every 10 miles, the survey would graph some of the bottom, and they look at the different total species within that benthic characteristic there. And that shows, you know, the species from minimum to maximum. Next slide. This shows the total biomass of that benthic species, not the differences, but the total. Which is indicative of production units and ecosystems. So wherever there's an awful lot of biomass and very very productive benthic habitat, we don't want it disturbed in terms of fishing. Next slide, please. The next slide shows fish. Total vertebrate species from the Science Center bottom trawl from 1998 to 2007 within the Gulf of Maine. Next slide. Next slide shows effort, fishing effort in terms of days at sea within the Gulf of Maine. Next slide. And I'll be fine-tuning these over time to present to the task force and to NROC. The next slide shows otter trawl activity in the Gulf of Maine. Next slide shows gillnet days fished 2004 to 2008, you can see how inshore there's an awful lot of inland activity in the Gulf of Maine that we wouldn't want disturbed. Next slide shows catch 2004 to 2008 from gillnets, again inshore Gulf of Maine. The next slide, effort in the lobster puck fishery from 2004 to 2008. And you can see within 30 miles of the coast is a substantial lobster effort and days fished. So we wouldn't want, whenever you're going to site any wind farms within, you know, 3 10-minute squares of the coast, you're going to be impacting lobster fisheries. Next slide, please. Now this is the RFI that I've asked the Science Center. This is south of Nantucket. And it provides some great insight to, you know, if the fisheries were involved in the RFI from the get-go, I certainly wouldn't establish itself in Nantucket in this area. So it goes to show you why we need all the stakeholders at the table early so we can develop a comprehensive plan rather than react to something that's already there. It's just not the way to do things. Again, this is the bottom sediment within that RFI south of Nantucket. Next slide. The next slide is chlorophyll A. When you're talking about the ecosystem, this is an indication of ecosystem energy and how productive that area can be. So you can see the dark red there. It's a very productive area for energy within an ecosystem. Next slide. Benthic survey, again, how productive the bottom is. You can see that the species richness is huge within that RFI. Next slide, the northeast corner of that slide shows otter trout activity, very high. Next slide, please. VTR catch data. Next slide. Observer catch data, they catch in pounds from otter trout. Next slide. VTR effort data from dredge. You can see that this is pretty significant, at least to the northeast and the east of that area, significant scallop catch. Millions of pounds, millions of dollars worth of catch for scallops. Next slide. VTR catch from scallop dredge. Again, the high activity on the eastern portion of that. Next slide, observer data 2006-09 on the scallop dredge. You can see again, tremendous scallop grounds there, tens of millions of dollars a year from that area. Next slide, please, VTR effort data for the gillnet fishery, the southwestern part. Next slide, VTR catch data from gillnet fishery 2006 to 2010, again, the southern part of the area, very high. Next slide, observer catch for gillnet area to the west, again very high. And last slide is VTR data in the lobster puck fishery right in the center of the area there, a significant lobster fishery offshore there. Next slide. And one other slide that the Science Center is working on for me along with the socioeconomic branch at the Science Center. Is I want to get these 10-minute squares with revenues so that in case there's any trade-offs or displacement between one industry and another, we can actually see the revenues from those 10-minute squares as well as the catch and the habitat and everything like that. So I think our Science Center has tremendous data. We'll continue to fine-tune it, and we need to be at the table to bring this data in early rather than respond to something that's already in place and have the negative attitudes after the fact. We want to bring the negative attitude before the fact. In summary, the fishing industry, fishermen, and the council need to get involved with the Bowman task forces right away. We need to get involved in the regional planning bodies as well when they're established. And right now in May, is going to be a national workshop in Washington, D.C. And sometime after that workshop, Washington will appoint the members of the regional planning bodies. And our state fisheries agencies and the regional councils have petitioned the National Ocean Council to become voting members of those regional planning bodies. And the heir apparent body, the Northeast Regional Ocean Council, NROC, has supported our request to be on their body, so I'm very pleased with that. The intent of the National Ocean Policy is to establish, as I said, comprehensive multi-sector plans throughout the region. This is not happening right now. Rather, it's just the opposite. BOMER is establishing state-by-state, singularly focused sector planning, not regional, and the adverse impacts on fishing. If we have a state-by-state issue without looking at it regionally, the likelihood that the adverse impacts will be significantly greater if those energy needs are not addressed comprehensively and regionally as planned. I can just see if we don't look at it holistically and comprehensively, every state will want to maximize energy, will want to maximize employment, will want to maximize financial gain in the EEZ. And where we may have, you know, a need, or we could balance three wind farms that would support five New England states, we may end up with five. And I don't like that. I think we need a regional focus so fishermen can be at the table to get involved in some trade-offs. So we need to protect our fishery resources and our fisheries economy. We need to make sure that wherever these wind farms are developed, that commercial and recreational fishing is not prohibited from operating within those areas.
Okay, thank you everybody, and thank you all of you for sitting very patiently and listening to about an hour of talk straight. Now it's your turn, you have about 25 minutes, and I know that our panelists are happy to answer most any questions that you can pose for them. And I also wanted to recognize a few people in the room. Senator Chris Rector is here, is one of the members of the BOEM Maine State Task Force. Also, Kathleen Layden, the director of the Coastal Program, is on that task force. Commissioner Olson also sits on that task force, as does one of our local representatives, McDonald. I'm not sure if he's here, but he was here earlier. So they may be able to answer questions. Ron Beck is also in the front here. He is the chief of the Energy and Facilities Branch for the Coast Guard. Some of you heard from him on the panel this morning, and he'd also be happy to answer questions from the Coast Guard perspective. Admiral Neptune, the district commander from the Coast Guard, is also in the back of the room. Thank you. Must have been Paul's boss at one. So we start out with questions.
Could you remember the BOEM presentation? There's a couple of slides here that I have questions about.
Paul, did you hear that request?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Probably.
And the slide I will start out with process.
Okay, can you ask your question while Paul is?
Yeah, well, I'm looking at, that's going to trigger what I'm saying.
Okay.
And then after that was said some of the timelines, and then there was a task force in the EAD.
Take another question.
Does somebody else have a question already?
I don't have a question per se, but just some comments. Bernie Feeney, Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association, I'm the president, and we've gone through this windmill scenario off of Coast of Hull, as well as the wind farm off of Nantucket. And one of the questions I ask consistently and never get an answer, have we ever had any kind of studies or any data to the effects of the electromagnetic field of the infrastructure of the cable running from the windmill to the land, to the transformer? And are we setting up fences, an invisible fence, if you will, envisioning a dog not leaving the yard, and stopping the migration patterns of maybe not lobster or fish, but maybe of a shrimp or some organism that these species will follow, and we're going to upset the migratory patterns of the very fish. And we won't know for quite some time after these projects are said and done. We don't have problems with windmills, and we understand the need. We understand that the wind is free and that, that this is a real green effort to try to get us off oil. But I don't have any answers. No one will give us that answer. And I think in conjunction with this fellow's studies, which are very comprehensive, we need those answers as a fishing community on a regional basis to find out that a windmill off of Maine may affect the cod migration that's caught in Mass Bay or vice versa, or a lobster migration in and out of the beach. Until we have that answer, I think we should be very leery to put this type of magnetic field in the ocean. I know there's a website, Cowrie, C-O-W-R-I-E, that I read consistently over in Great Britain, who have done extensive studies, and they know that the audio damage to marine mammals, whales and seals, is within 100 kilometers of a windmill pump. They also know that there's a magnetic field issue. Now, it depends on the kilowatts and all the other things, and I'm not a scientist or an engineer, I can't give you those answers. But they have affected salmon fisheries up in the fjords. They know this already. We need to be very, very sure before we give up one economic engine for another. And that's just a comment I have, and I think we need to go that direction and have some answers on that.
That is an issue that's been identified with this before. In our Pacific office, there's a study going on about the electromagnetic effects on wildlife. And we specifically asked them to add the American lobster onto that to test those effects as well as part of that study, which they agreed to do. So we should have at least some more data coming out. That's not my department.
It's marine life.
I don't really know when
we're expecting. But it may be the feed of lobsters, or it may be the feed of cod, or maybe the herring, or something that won't go over a threshold that makes everything happen for us in a bay or an estuary or something.
It's clearly something that needs study, and that's why we're contracting the work to have it studied. I don't know how you could study every critter out there before, you know, but we have at least identified it as an issue.
What he's asking for is an ecosystem approach, and I think it probably needs to be taken into account. To say you can't study every critter dismisses the fact that we all live in this place together. I mean, it may be difficult, but he's right. You may not know what you're doing if you don't look at the shrimp or all species that may be involved. It's not our problem, I realize.
I understand it's a big concern. But
I just want to reiterate the Calgary website that you mentioned is a really good resource. I know just for myself and my own background research, they have a lot of studies and data on there from the wind farms that are in place and operating in the ocean off the coast of Europe, involved with the different and the floating platforms that would potentially be off Maine. There's some similar ones that are proposed for Massachusetts, and a lot of that information could be really interesting to people. Mark, do you want to get back to
your identification. I'm confused, which may not mean there's confusion here, but on the timeline for NEPA here, on this slide it says issue of lease in red, which says red require a NEPA review. Would that be a trigger? And if that's a trigger, what triggers it by the issue of lease? And then secondly, down there, the next step, it says site assessment plan on the part of the lease seed. Is that an environmental assessment? Is that in addition to NEPA?
NEPA applies to major federal actions, like the Green Act assessments over here.
Yeah.
The issuing the lease does count as a trigger. I think the plan right now is to start with environmental assessments, and that will, I mean, that doesn't mean you're going to end up with a FONSI, or a finding no significant impact. It means you're doing the environmental assessment to see what the impact is, and if there's going to be a significant impact, then you do an EIS. So, but my understanding is for issuing lease, we're looking at site assessment activities and lease issuance, and then if merited, that would trigger, that the EA could turn into an EIS. But, I'm not in the environmental.
Okay, two slides later.
But hold on.
Well, I was just going to, I work with Ray Bryant, but it is two NEPA steps. So there's the NEPA process, the trigger of the issuance of the lease, and and there would be an additional NEPA process after construction prior to any construction or operations.
That's the approved plan.
There's two NEPA steps.
NEPA comes in, there's an individual assessment.
But each individual project does receive an environmental
plan. Okay. The process you've got going on right now, within where the comments are very extended on Massachusetts?
That's before even that we've started NEPA.
What's that?
That's before we even started the NEPA process.
Okay.
We're just asking for interest.
The NEPA process comes in after that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, in two slides later, maybe it was the next slide. Yeah. You said wind energy areas, and then it says currently conducting NEPA analysis on the effect of surveys in these. Are you currently?
Or we have a Mid-Atlantic EA that's underway right now that's looking at, so it's
New Jersey.
Areas in New Jersey,
Delaware,
Maryland, Virginia.
Right. So this is not applied here. Right now.
Well, that. No, oh, for here in Maine, though.
No, okay, so that's confusing.
Sorry about that. Right, no, Maine would be, I mean, it's possible that at some point in the future they'll identify areas and do another.
Where are you with being at the same stage as Massachusetts where you are now? How far away in Maine are you from that?
We're not there yet. So I'm not on the task force.
Well, I'm not a member of the task force either, but as Mr. Wright had, or Mr. Frank, excuse me, had suggested, there had been two meetings of the Bulmer Maine task force. The first one was initially to, was more or less a meet and greet. We also reviewed existing spatial data in the state of Maine. The second one was more or less to take a finer look at that data and see if there were opportunities to go for Maine. Also, as he suggested, that initiative is currently just awaiting additional guidance from the current administration. There are some task force members here. That's about as much information as I can give that I know of anyway. If you care to, anyone would like to step in here, maybe a task force member.
Anybody else want to talk about this?
There's really not much more to say that Bulmer is required to consult the states and the task force is that process. Task force members need to be elected officials, so there are a whole slew of people that were on the task force as of December that are no longer elected officials. There's been no movement to reappoint folks, and they're literally, as Matt said, awaiting guidance from the administration to come out before convening the next meeting of the task force.
Okay, I know that you just extended the comment period for Massachusetts because some people were complaining that there wasn't enough adequate time.
I'm not sure it's actually been published in the Federal Register yet, but yeah, we're extending it 30 days.
Okay.
To give people, and I think that was an outgrowth of the meeting in New Bedford.
So that's one of the things we're always concerned about adequate time. Comments are strong and all of a sudden you've got.
I'm curious, we have the test sites that were up early, and the test sites are all around an island. And I mean, if I want to catch a fish that's beside a wharf, I stand on the wharf. So why aren't we putting the test windmills on the island instead of around the island? They wouldn't interfere with any fisheries that way.
Well, the legislation that charged us with siting these demonstration sites initially told us to site these offshore to test offshore energy, which is these floating platforms in state waters. I think that's probably the best answer for that. There's been Maine is leading New England in terms of terrestrial wind power installed, and there's also the Fox Island Wind's development on the bottom of it. So I mean, there are developments that are currently operating on the land. The idea here is to test technology that doesn't exist elsewhere. We know that a turbine can spin. We know it can generate electricity. We don't know. The idea is to really test what platform would succeed the best in Maine, and that's what these test sites were designated for, to see which ones would float, which ones would stand up to the conditions up here. Anything to add? No?
I'm Gary Levy. I'm a fisherman. I ground fish, I shrimp, I lobster, butterfly. My concerns are a lot the same with the fellow from Massachusetts Club Association. What happens to the energy fields around the bowl, where the cables come to the shore, how the process works. Will fishermen have an opportunity to be part of the process? I'm glad to see Paul back there, because I know Paul from the council, and I know he's involved, and we do have some protection, but we feel like maybe we don't have a lot of protection because we're out of the process. That has helped us quite a bit. I would know nothing about this if it wasn't for her. So the more involved we can get, the happier we're going to be, and we'd like to be part of the process.
Just as a clarification, process, you mean in the broader sense or in the test site sense?
Broader sense. Yeah, the whole thing, it's like David here was saying earlier about our concerns are access. That's number one. What's going to happen to the fish migrations? That's a concern. What about all the little creatures? We have to know how the patterns may change. That can change our whole businesses. We can lose our businesses just from that. We could lose our businesses from loss of access. We want to be part of this process.
I think just to answer that, at least from the demonstration setting process, as I had sort of alluded to in the presentation, the first folks that we went to were fishermen to let them know about this very early on in the process. In the broader sense, Commissioner Olson is a member of the task force, and in an earlier presentation this morning, he said that he would be paying very close attention to anything that went forward in the Gulf of Maine or off Maine's coast. So I know you have a friend there as well.
Yeah,
there's
always
a
contact.
I also wanted to note, Senator Rafter and Representative McDonald are on the task force. In addition, here in the room are some members of the Marine Resources Committee, and they definitely are here because they want to hear how people are feeling about that. The chair, Senator Somelo, is here, as well as Representative Kruger in the back. So, and probably others who, if you want to raise your hand so people know to come and talk to you, I'm sure they're happy to hear what people are thinking along the coast. Right, did you want to quickly address the specific points at which fishermen or fisheries organizations can actually have a say in a review process?
Any notice and comment period, I know that, you know, that has its own problems, but we really do welcome comments from people who know more than we do about the ocean. And through through representatives on task forces, certainly. So if you can talk to any of the members of the task forces, I'm sure a lot of people would like to help be conduits for this kind of support.
Good question in the back, yep.
Yes, I'm John Mason. I'm working with a fishery interest that is being affected by something in our society along the mid-Atlantic Eastern Seaboard. And the first week we got out of this was the release of the Massachusetts RFI. So I started doing some research into the other task force efforts that you've been carrying out, and I was very surprised to discover an RFI that had been issued and completed and months ago in Delaware, another one in Maryland, and then you go through the testimony that has come in from those two RFIs, and you can count the number of comments that come in from various interests on two hands. So the question, my first question is, you have a NEPA-led process, you are soliciting comments, you just said you want comments from fishermen's associations, anybody can comment, but if nobody knows about it, how would they get in the queue? Second of all, you go to your website and you read about task forces that have taken place in various states, and you see that it's a non-factor process, so there's no requirement for notification, there's no requirement to invite the public into it, you can't exclude the public, but it's really surprising to me to see very few members of the public other than wind interests as observers at these meetings. And it appears that only states where you've got states actively participating, except the state island. They are encouraging public process, but you have actually a lot of public involvement. Rhode Island, I think Maine is on the way to making, to ensuring that there's adequate public involvement. But it's clear that BOEM is not making that happen through your efforts. Are you relying on the states? So is it the states that have responsibility for getting people in the room and getting people to testify?
We certainly haven't been hiding any of the activities. We've been putting out press releases. We've been trying to get the word out as best we can. We clearly can do better when it comes to the fishery community, and that's probably why I'm here in part, and to try to solicit more of that engagement. So it is still early in the game. Nothing's been decided yet, and so
I'm familiar.
Partly encourage you to engage now.
I'm familiar with NEPA process, and I understand how it's intended to unfold.
Well, these notice and comments that we're talking about now are not NEPA notice and comments, with the exception of the Mid-Atlantic Regional EA. Okay. Or for the request for interest, these are to satisfy our requirement that we clear the competition. So this is before we even get to a NEPA. In Massachusetts, there's no NEPA going on in Massachusetts right now. This is just so there are still, we're still early. It's still early.
So second question, and it is still early. And it seems to me that somebody's really interested in seeing it done right and seeing the fishing industry being able to coexist as an industry with a new industry on the scene, which has been popular. One wonders if this process that you've laid out is going to actually yield kind of policy guidance that's going to let it be done right for the long term. I mean, there are a huge number of unanswered questions that are going to require not just assembling all the data we've got in layers, but it's going to take analysis, it's going to take people sitting down and making some priority decisions, your policy decisions. Okay? They're priority calls. They aren't necessarily something that you can, you know, just pick off the shelf. Okay. Who at BOEM is going to make those policy decisions on citing, on eventually what leases is? Understanding they're only going to be a small fraction of the areas that being considered, but who are going to make those policy calls? Who are going to decide whether there are aspects of ecosystems that need to be protected in, or not?
At least in part, it will be our office. I know that the Maryland RFI, we're taking part of that off because of navigational concerns from the Coast Guard. And so when we hear about concerns that we feel like really, you know, make an area non-viable, we take it off the table.
Yes.
My comment is in support of the gentleman from, I think it's Rolling on Options, is that if I was to select an organism to test the effect of an electromagnetic field, it would be the lobster. They're very, very sensitive, and they detect oil, and as far as their communications, I think that's complex also. The data's out there. You have the MBL at Woods Hole that studied lobsters for a long time. And then there's this organization in outside of Friendship, Maine, that studies lobsters. They have a lot of information. But you don't have to worry about the invertebrates in general. They're sort of, well, brain dead compared to lobsters and other crustaceans. That's where you want to focus. That's where the economy is.
I can actually put Pete on the spot, maybe to mention some studies that I know are starting on that topic.
Yeah, the electromagnetic field work is really complicated. We couldn't do it in this room. There's too much electrical noise. Animals are that sensitive. And for the test operation in Monkegan, there isn't even a cable. But we're trying to look ahead as part of the deep sea wind program and anticipate these kinds of issues. We've been involved with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory that DOE operates. They've spent the last 3 years getting set up to do both field and laboratory tests on potentially sensitive organisms. The ones that are going to be the most sensitive are the ones that migrate because they
a fraction of those that migrate use magnetic fields. Others use polarized light in order to navigate. But it's definitely on the radar screen here. It's definitely part of the process already in meeting in terms of what's being worked on. But we welcome this kind of input.
Question?
Sebastian Bell with the Maine Aquaculture Association. I just want to remind folks, and I haven't heard mentioned once here, except with the exception of Dave's presentation, with one reference, I think, to the Ocean State Aquaculture Association. Aquaculture is a stakeholder in this as well, and Paul, in particular, your presentation, I'd like you to modify it to have commercial fishing, recreational fishing, and aquaculture, because the reality is it's quite likely that over time we will find ourselves operating in federal waters, and we want to be included in the discussion as well, in particular because we're currently often not viewed as stakeholders because we're not there yet. So under our marine spatial planning exercise, if you're just documenting current uses, but you're not documenting potential future uses, you may actually be inadvertently excluding an area that may actually result in significant economic activity, employment, and certainly help with the seafood trade deficit. So we would ask to be included in this as well.
Yeah. Mr. Frank, you had mentioned that we're way out ahead in front of this process in a sense. I'd like to just mention to you that in the fishing industry, there's never too far out ahead. We're a very segmented group. Some of us have representation, some of us don't. Some of us talk to each other, some of us don't. Some of us are in New Jersey and the Mid-Atlantic, and some of us are here up in Maine. You know, it's very difficult, or it's very easy, I should say, for you to say we're way out ahead in front of this. But, you know, things just don't come down to the fishing industry as you would imagine they do. Just as many of us haven't heard anything about this meeting that Paul mentioned in May in D.C. And as John mentioned, we haven't heard anything about anything, pretty much, considering what has gone on. So we really need to hear much, much more, and you have to realize that we do need, as Paul said, to be much more involved. We are all stakeholders. This is our economy, our bread and butter, it's how we feed our families, and potentially we're seeing all of that dry up.
Just in response to that, the coastal program and Maine DMR for a period of time over the last couple of months has been presenting at zone council some of this new policy just to let folks know and to ask them how they would like us to engage in the future, you know, the forms of communication, whether it be going back out to the zone councils, that sort of thing. That effort is currently, we're currently just awaiting additional guidance, but it was more or less to inform about the National Ocean Policy, to inform about efforts in the state of Maine, just to keep that. Obviously, there are other industries, and there's only so many of us to go around. We're going to get to you, don't worry. But that was part of the effort, and again, we're just waiting to see how to move forward here.
If I can just follow up very quickly, This is a great venue right here, right now, and this draws a lot of people. But I have members down in New Jersey, in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island, and we've not had anything like this. And so it really is expansive, and we need to be able to get this information out to all of us.
It is 2:30 now, so we have time just for one last question, and then we need to wrap up.
Just curious, why the MMS changed their name? Did it have anything to do with the oil spill or everything?
Yes.
You're free to speculate.
Why should we be confident in your ability to manage this kind of an industry and protect our fisheries at the same time, based on that experience?
Okay, well, I do want to thank everyone for coming. There's obviously a lot of interest. Please talk to each other. And thank you again to Paul Howard, who's our sponsor from the forum board.